Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
This program was made possible by grants from Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, and 23andMe. 23andMe is a virtual genetic testing company. We really want to thank both Genentech and 23andMe for their collaborative partnership in making today's program possible.
Now, we have sent you some materials from Cancer Care, and those materials, you receive them either by mail or you got them electronically, and they include information about our speakers as well as information about the topics that are being covered and also information about all of the different collaborating organizations. And there also is in your materials an evaluation form, and we ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us how these programs can be most helpful to you? Indeed, today's topic is one that many of you have asked us to offer over and over again. It's so important, and we feel that you're our best consultants in terms of the programs we should be offering. So please tell us what you'd like us to offer, and we'll try very hard to produce those programs for you. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Lowell Anthony. And Dr. Anthony is Professor of Medicine, Division of Medical Oncology, Markey Cancer Center, University of Kentucky. And Dr. Anthony is going to review an overview of clinical trials, why they are important, and what happens in a clinical trial. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Anthony.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you today about a topic that many of us are in academic medicine exactly for this purpose. What motivates us each day is to get better, to advance medicine, because we're never satisfied with outcomes. You might say, what is a clinical trial? This is a formal process that a product would go through in order to go from concept to actual practice. There is a period of time that a sponsor will gain information on their product in what we call the preclinical period. If a drug makes it out of the preclinical period, then there's this formal process in humans called clinical trials, then is the next step. We think of clinical trials in various phases. The initial phase we call phase zero, where it's first in man or first in woman, you know, or first in human trials, where a subtherapeutic dose will be given. And these early studies will be focused more on how the drug may be cleared. So this, the science of doing this is called pharmacokinetics. So they blood levels or urine levels, sometimes CSF levels, are obtained to see how the body may clear a product and also how the drug may work, looking at some effector mechanism in this early stages, what we call the pharmacodynamics of an agent. When we start moving a drug along, if it gets out of that early phase, then it goes into phase one that is really all about safety, where the drug is given at various doses, and there's very specific ways of escalating these doses. There are usually groups of three people in each group, and once a drug is given to three people, and if zero or one have a dose-limiting toxicity, then the drug will be escalated. But once two out of three have what's considered to be a dose-limiting toxicity, then the dose that goes into the next phase, or phase two, would be one less than what's called the maximally tolerated dose. So now as we move into phase two, we're starting to focus on how good the drug might be at a specific dose or two in a specific disease state. So a phase one would really not be specific to a disease state, but phase two would be. So that you may see many phase twos created over the same drug, And here, there's really not a randomization in general. We are moving into some larger randomized trials to save money, as pharmaceutical companies have learned over the years that large phase 3 trials that don't advance the drug can be very expensive. So in order to become more efficient, larger phase 2 trials are in the process of being used. But historically, we've limited the number of people in a phase 2 trial, usually between maybe 100, at the most 300, and that would allow, in today's world, a possible randomization if it's all one trial in one disease state. In the phase 1 trials, we usually have it 20 to 80 in general. So you can see as we go up in the phase 0s, where there may be 10 to 15 subjects, we're significantly going up in exposures. Now, the phase 3 trials is really where the change in practice occurs. A phase 3 trial will randomize a product against what's considered the standard of care. So that participating in a phase 3 trial, you're always going to get everything that you normally would get, but with the prospects or the promise of something new and different. And that could be a drug that's added on to the standard of care drug, or it could be the next generation standard of care drug, or something that's been tweaked to a certain extent to make the clinical trial of value. So as we move into phase 3 trials, it's not uncommon to have 1,000 and sometimes even up to 3,000 people included in such a trial to really confirm how effective is the intervention. As these phase 2s and phase 3 go on, there's clearly monitoring side effects, and it's really only when you get a drug into 1,000 or more people that you're really identifying many of the additional safety signals that you may have not gotten in those early phase 1 trials when you're under 80 subjects. So if a successful phase 3 trial is conducted, then the investigational arm then would become the standard of care. Frequently, it takes two types of trials to convince, or two reports, a confirmatory report, but it really depends on how good that phase 3 trial was, whether it needs to be reproduced or not. And then once a drug is on the market, there's a what's called phase 4 trial that the sponsor is obligated to conduct additional reporting once their new agent is being sold and in the marketplace. And it's during that time that any additional safety signals, as their drug will go into tens of thousands of people, will then become maybe identified. So what happens exactly in a clinical trial is that if you're interested in it, you have to accept the limitations of the clinical trial, and the clinical trial has to accept you. So it's really a two-way street. You can't just decide, I want to enroll, and then I want to get on a certain arm or such. In a phase 2 trial, you would know pretty much what you'd be getting, unless it's a randomized phase 2, and that would be clear up front that you might not be assigned to that specific treatment. But if it's non-randomized, then frequently the comparison will be the historical norm for that condition. And that's not as robust and doesn't usually get a drug approved, but it does generate additional ideas and thoughts and hypotheses to go forward with a potential phase 3 trial. So there are things called inclusion and exclusion criteria that they're trying to identify a fairly homogeneous population of subjects that they can then make an intervention and not have what's called confounding variables, that they can do their intervention with the trial and then measure their outcomes and apply statistical testing to know whether it has value. So I'm going to go ahead and pass this back to Carolyn. It's been a great afternoon talking with you.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Anthony, for just a wonderful introduction to clinical trials and to presenting an overview of them. I want to thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. John Leonard. Dr. Leonard is the Richard T. Silver Distinguished Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College, Clinical Director, New York Cornell Center for Lymphoma and Myeloma. He's Chief Lymphoma Myeloma Service, Associate Director for Clinical Research, Weill Cornell Cancer Center. Dr. Leonard wears many hats, and he's going to address today the meaning of informed consent, benefits of participation, and risks of participation. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Leonard.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to this audience today. So my topic is really focused around how a patient decides whether or not they want to participate in a clinical trial. That's really the simple question. And as you've heard from Dr. Anthony, there are lots and lots and lots of different aspects of clinical trials that can be quite complicated. And on the other hand, while it's a tremendous opportunity in some situations, it is very important when considering participating in clinical trials that patients and their families, in the case of a joint decision-making process, as many of us have family and friends that have input into our decisions, that we really understand the pros and cons and what it means to participate. And so the aspects of getting treatment for a cancer patient or a patient with any medical condition for that matter, the physician usually explains to the patient, okay, here's the treatment and here we go. There may be some discussion of different options in general medical care, but in a clinical trial, we are appropriately held to a much higher standard. And the idea is that because we are not only treating individuals in the case of certain cancer and other protocols where the intervention, the process, it may include an individual treatment for a patient or a subject, depending on your perspective, we are held to a standard to make very, very sure that the patient understands what the situation is and what's involved in participating. And so typically, clinical trials go through a very complicated process. Dr. Anthony alluded to some of this in his remarks, where various processes are taken, various committees, various regulatory authorities look at a clinical trial and make sure that it's an appropriate thing to be doing, that it is ethical to be doing for individuals in the given situation that would make them eligible for the trial. And then they also require that the consent form, which is a document that describes the clinical trial, is very clear. It's at a level where a layperson can understand it, so you don't need any special training to understand the consent form, or you shouldn't. And then it's complete, meaning that the consent form outlines the patient's situation, the individual situation, what is involved in the clinical trial, what are the tests, what are the processes that the individual will go through. And that it's very clear what your obligations are from the standpoint of when you're going to need to come into the doctor's office, what's going to happen when you're there, what other tests are going to be done as part of that, which of those are standard treatment, i.e. if you're getting routine medical care, these are things that would happen anyway in the normal course of routine medical care. And then what are things that are required as part of the study that are above and beyond that? Because many clinical trials require that you do something extra as part of being on the trial, whether that's extra testing or extra monitoring or extra people looking at your chart and looking at your information, because part of what we're doing is not only in the case of treatment trials to treat the patient, but we're also trying to understand and gather information on this. And so the informed consent document explains all of this, or should explain all of this very well. It also discusses your financial obligations from the standpoint of what are you responsible financially, your insurance, above and beyond what you would be. And sometimes There is no extra. Most of the time, there's very little extra obligation to the patient, but sometimes there can be. In those cases, typically those extra expenses are covered by the clinical trial, but that's not always entirely the case, and so one needs to understand that very carefully. And then the consent form also describes the alternatives from the standpoint of what are the other options. And obviously an option for a patient who's being offered a clinical trial may be to not participate, to get standard treatment. And so one very much needs to understand what the pros and cons are. Now, we refer often to informed consent as being a document, but in fact, informed consent is not a document. A document, a piece of paper that outlines this in writing for you, is part of it, but really, informed consent is a process. It's an interaction between the patient or the subject, in the case of the person considering participation, and the care team. And that can be the physician. It can be a different physician who's an investigator on the study. It can be other people that are part of the study. These can be nurses or what we call data managers or study coordinators, depending on the center. And these are extra people involved. And so if you're considering participating in a clinical trial, one of the good parts is that other people are involved in your care in this course. And I look at it as a physician as another set of eyes keeping tabs on what I'm doing. And while I may be pretty good at what I do, sometimes I make mistakes, and having other people keeping track of and keeping me on the straight and narrow and looking over my shoulder as part of a patient's treatment often helps to make sure that everything is being done well. It also provides extra resources to the patient or the subject because it gives you someone else who can give you information, is available to you for input, is keeping tabs on you, is asking you questions about how things are going. And so it's often said that the care patients get as part of a clinical trial in some cases can be better than routine care because, in fact, there are extra people involved keeping an eye on things. And so I think in many cases that's, in fact, among the benefits of participation. Now, other benefits of participation of clinical trials really depend on the specific clinical trial and the specific situation. Sometimes one is receiving standard treatment. Sometimes one is receiving something in addition to standard treatment. There are very few placebos in cancer clinical trials. One would only use a placebo if the standard of care would be to do nothing, or it would be to do nothing in addition to the standard treatment. So the benefits of participation might include the option to get a drug or a drug that's being developed that is still being studied and is not yet generally available. And so if that's a promising option for a patient as far as something that might be able to help their situation, that's a potential benefit. The additional people being involved in the study and looking at the patient and keeping tabs on the treatment program, that's a potential benefit. Other benefits include benefits to society, because really when any time a doctor or a nurse or a treatment team member goes into a patient's room and sits and talks about the different treatment options, the prognosis, that is because we've done clinical trials. And so clearly any progress that we make depends on clinical trials, and that's a benefit. The risks of participation are, on the flip side, the fact that there may be more effort involved, there may be more doctor visits, there may be more testing. Sometimes that testing has some risks, and so that needs to be balanced against the potential benefits. It also, when we are using new drugs or new treatment regimens, by definition, we're still learning about them. And so while we explain all of the risks that we know, and it's an obligation of a physician/investigator that's treating patients on a clinical trial to tell you all that we know about a new treatment regimen or a new drug, there are still things that we are still learning, and so we might be surprised, and there might be some extra things that happen that we didn't know about, or some a side effect might be more common than we thought, and so part of the or more severe than we thought, and so part of the clinical trial is to establish all of that, and that's a potential risk of participation. And so depending on one's situation, how one looks at the benefits and the risks may be very individualized. If you have very few other options, you might look at it one way. If you have lots of options and the standard treatment looks pretty good, then you might look at it a different way. But in each of those cases, there are scenarios where participation in a clinical trial might add something to your care. And in fact, in many situations, clinical trials might not be interventional, meaning they might not be treatment trials, but there are clinical studies that are done at many centers where we're gathering information that might not be geared toward specifically treating the condition, but at least learning about the condition. And so there are lots of other studies that may, by some definitions, not be trials, but may be offered to patients that contribute to the knowledge in this field. So at the end of the day, this all comes down to the specific situation, the details of the clinical trial, the details of the patient's situation, and that really all then is brought to the patient through the informed consent process that seeks to explain all this very clearly and help a patient get the best information possible to help them make an informed decision. So with that, I'll stop and I'll turn it over to our next speaker.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Leonard, for making the complex very understandable. So thank you very much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Edith Mitchell. And Dr. Mitchell is Clinical Professor of Medicine and Medical Oncology, Program Leader, Gastrointestinal Oncology, Department of Medical Oncology. She's Associate Director of Diversity Programs and Director, Center for Elimination of Cancer Disparities, Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson. Dr. Mitchell also wears many hats, and Dr. Mitchell is going to address a number of topics, including how you can participate in clinical trials, questions to ask your healthcare team, supportive care and quality of life clinical trials, accessing resources for clinical trials, and a little discussion about virtual trials as well. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Mitchell.
Carolyn, thank you so much. And it is my pleasure to and privilege to be with such a distinguished team of speakers today, and for all of our listeners, and I thank you very much. So I am going to cover a number of topics, but the bottom line is, why are clinical trials important, and how can patients access these clinical trials? So why are they important? They're really important to help us develop better methods of prevention, detection, as well as treating cancer, and then the follow-up of the patient after they have been treated for the cancer. In January of this year, there was an important article written by the members from the American Cancer Society, and this showed that in the United States, over the last 20 years, there has been a 20% decrease in cancer deaths in this country. And the greatest contributor to a decrease in cancer deaths and more patients living longer is the concept and the process of clinical trials. So what are clinical trials? You've heard from our other speakers that these clinical trials, various ones, can help define new treatments. But not only do clinical trials define new treatments, they can help us find new ways to diagnose cancer, ways to prevent cancer, and then ways to manage the symptoms of cancer or either the side effects of the treatments that patients receive. So not all trials are designed to give a drug to treat the cancer. And things that the patient should ask are really very simple ones. The reason why this trial is being done, who can join the trial, and one of our previous speakers spoke about the eligibility requirements for the trial. How many patients are needed? Are there any drugs that will be given? And Dr. Leonard mentioned, are there medical costs? Are there costs of testing? How frequently will I have to come into the center to be checked after going into this trial? So there are a number of questions that one can ask. So let's talk about the prevention trials. These prevention trials are made to try and decrease the risk of developing cancer. For some individuals who have a higher risk of developing cancer or who have standard risks. So there are clinical trials. Probably one of the most talked about clinical trials is that of the use of aspirin to decrease the incidence of cancer in certain individuals and for a number of different cancers. So very important. Prevention trials. There are trials that involve whether vitamins, for example, might decrease the risk and lower the risk of development of certain types of cancer. So prevention trials are very important. There are also the screening trials. And screening trials means that we are evaluating what appear to be normal healthy individuals and then finding a cancer that had not given symptoms yet, and therefore finding the cancer at an earlier stage. And usually for most cancers, the earlier you are diagnosed with cancer, the better are the treatment results or outcomes. So screening trials. And an example of a screening trial is colonoscopy. Everybody has heard about the age 50 when you're supposed to get this screening colonoscopy. So screening trials are very important. I've mentioned the treatment trials, but also there are trials that evaluate the quality of life while undergoing cancer treatment, or in survivors of individuals who presumably have been cured of the cancer. There are also supportive care trials that help the patients get through the treatment. For example, supportive care could find new ways to help individuals cope with pain that might occur as the result of cancer, or nutrition problems, since many patients either lose weight because of the cancer or as a result of treatment. Nausea, vomiting is another, loss of sleep or sleep disorders. So there are many health problems that potentially could occur as the result of cancer treatment. So these are all important. There are also palliative care trials, and these are for individuals who might have very advanced cancer, and therefore the clinical trial is designed to evaluate a treatment that might decrease pain or might decrease suffering as a result of the cancer or as the result of treatment. One of the things that a patient or the family would want to know is the randomization process. How is it decided whether I will receive treatment number one or two, or A or B, as they are sometimes called? And you'll want to know if the trial is blinded, if you will know exactly what kind of medication you are receiving. Dr. Anthony mentioned earlier phase three trials that evaluate perhaps the addition of a medicine to standard care. So with a trial like this, there's standard care, and some patients may receive this medication that might improve results. And to verify that and to validate it, some patients might also, on a different arm, receive the standard of care with a placebo. And this is absolutely very important to confirm that a treatment, when added to standard of care, is beneficial. So all of these questions are very important. It's also important to know the research team members. Who is evaluating the process? Dr. Leonard mentioned the evaluation of the process. There's a principal investigator. There can be other physicians or pharmacists, research nurses, and a data manager just to keep all of the numbers organized so that the principal investigator has information that is very valid. There can be other staff members who are working with the principal investigator to evaluate and assess the patients, to accurately record information, and to keep it organized so that information can be very useful. So that's all very important. Dr. Leonard mentioned about paying for clinical trials. Sometimes the insurance companies cover, but these are questions you will want to ask. How are the healthcare costs covered? Whether certain tests are covered by insurance, and whether or not parking and other conveniences to arrive at the institution for treatment are covered. You will also want to know what is the purpose of the trial, how do the researchers believe that the treatment should be studied. Dr. Anthony mentioned hypotheses. So these are hypotheses. Why is it that we think this treatment or method would be more effective? You'll also want to know how long are you going to be in the clinical trial? What kind of test? How will the doctors know that a treatment or a modality is working? And what will happen if it's not working? How will an X-ray be used or other imaging tests? In other words, you will want to know what criteria will the doctors use to confirm that the clinical trial is effective and it's working properly. You will also want to know what are the risks and benefits to the patient, or what are the risks and benefits to anyone who might be near the patient. There are some clinical trials where there are risks not only to the patient, but there may be risk to other individuals who they come in contact with. You will want to know, what are my rights to find the information? How will I receive the information that occurs as the result of that trial? And whether this trial will affect daily and routine life activities. Will I have to stay in the hospital? How long will it require me to be at the hospital? And how frequently will I have to come for checkups? So all of these are very important to gain the information from the clinical trial and to take the advantage of the clinical trial by participation. Now, another issue is where clinical trials take place. Clinical trials can take place in many different institutions. There are some institutions, such as the academic institutions, that develop clinical trials. There are other community resources, such as hospital or physicians' offices throughout the country that offer clinical trials. So you will want to know, where is the clinical trial taking place? How will I get there? And where can I get information about clinical trials? On the internet, there are just tons of clinical trials available. How will you know whether it's a good clinical trial or not? For basic purposes, I always recommend to my patients, as well as my students and interns and residents working with me, clinicaltrials.gov. That is a bona fide site, and every clinical trial on that site is verified by someone, so that's a good site, but not all sites are good. And one way of determining whether a trial is good is whether it's listed in clinicaltrials.gov. But another way to get additional information is to talk it over with your doctor. Your doctor may give you information about the trial. They may also arrange for a consultation at a center that is sponsoring that trial. So always feel free to talk with your doctor about the clinical trial. That brings us to making clinical trials available to everyone in this country. Many institutions, including the National Cancer Institute, has made tremendous efforts to increase the availability of clinical trials in this country. So there, for cancer clinical trials, for example, there are the cooperative groups, the community hospital research programs, so there are many opportunities. There are also innovative methods trying to decrease the cost of clinical trials, to make them available to more individuals, and to decrease the cost of clinical trials. And one of the ways is an innovative medical design called virtual clinical trials, or virtual prototyping tools. And this is another way of increasing the availability of trials. There have been some that have been very important. For example, in the pediatric world, since there are few children with cancer compared to adults, of course, but there are a number of very successful pediatric virtual clinical trials. Brain tumor, which is a more rare form of cancer, is another area where the virtual clinical trials have been extremely helpful. And another system, and it's of course very prominent in many states, but for example, the University of Virginia has a virtual clinical trial system, making clinical trials available to physicians and to their patients in rural areas of Virginia. And that's true in a number of other states too. So I will turn it back over to Carolyn in just a moment. And I'll summarize by saying that clinical trials are very important for medical advancements. For cancer clinical trials, those trials may involve new treatments, but may also involve new methods of diagnosing cancer or better methods of diagnosing cancer. And there are also the cancer prevention trials, the cancer screening trials, trying to find cancers at an earlier stage, and then those quality of life or supportive care or palliative care trials that are trying to decrease the suffering associated with cancer or its treatment. So with that, I thank you very much for your attention. And Carolyn, it's back to you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mitchell. That was wonderful and very comprehensive. And now we do have time for questions. We have actually a lot of time for questions. And I'm going to ask our moderator, I'm going to ask Kate to go ahead and bring all of our speakers on board, and also to actually give people directions on how to ask questions. And we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. Kate?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
We have a question from one of our online participants, and the question is, would I not be considered for a clinical trial because I'm elderly? Dr. Anthony, would you address that?
Now, age does not necessarily play a role to exclude someone. It's very important for clinical trials to include people of all ages. However, representing geriatric patients, and that would be defined potentially above 70, clinical trials can have a tendency not to include this age group as well. So we're very conscious of that, and I'd like to say that we would not want to a priori say that age is a determinant for not participating.
Thank you. That's really so important. Thank you so much. And another question from one of our online participants is, what happens if I decide to leave the trial? So Dr. Leonard, could you address that?
Yes. So clinical trials are not a contract forever, meaning that clinical trials, you are generally able to decide that you change your mind, whether it's the same day or whether it's a year or 2 years into it. If you Your feelings have changed, your situation have changed. You generally are able to discontinue. The only cases where that is something that is a little more complicated is if it were unsafe for you to do that, i.e., if you were having some sort of side effect. We wouldn't want you to leave in the middle of a clinical trial. We might stop the treatment, but we wouldn't want you to leave and never come back, because we want to make sure that whatever side effect that you're dealing with has resolved and been taken care of. But the consent form typically spells that out, and it's very important for people to understand that that clinical trials, you are allowed to discontinue participation at any point in time should you feel like that's the best decision for you. Obviously, if you don't think you're going to continue, if it's a clinical trial that goes on for, let's say, a year, and you're not wanting to participate more than a month or two, and you know that at the beginning, then it's probably not a good idea to enroll in the study to begin with, because that wouldn't meet everyone's objectives and best interests. But yes, if you decide to change your mind at any point, you can do so and come off of the study.
Excellent. That's, I think, often people have that question and wonder. Thank you for that kind of answering that question. Another question that that comes up from one of our online participants is, what should I take into consideration before agreeing to participate in a clinical trial? And Dr. Mitchell, could you address that question?
Certainly. Well, first of all, I think it's important to discuss, and let's talk about cancer clinical, make sure we're talking about cancer clinical trials. You'll want to know the stage of your disease. You'll want to know the pathology, meaning exactly what kind of tumor that you have and what is the extent of that tumor before you consider a clinical trial. And then if you have questions about either of those choices, the pathology or the stage, again, talk with your physician about it, and don't ever hesitate to ask the clinical trial staff questions. I always say the worst question that you can have is the one that you never ask. So always ask questions. You will also need to discuss with the clinical trials team medications that you may be taking now or have taken in the past, other medical conditions that you have, all of your treating physicians' names, addresses, and what medical problem they are treating you for. So it's really all of this information, when put together with the eligibility criteria for the study, that will help make it easier for a patient to participate, safer for a patient to participate, and therefore make it more likely that you will have good treatment outcomes from the clinical trial and successful participation in clinical trial.
Excellent, thank you. And we have a question in front of our online participants. I'm going to ask everyone to weigh in on it, but I'm going to ask Dr. Anthony to go first. If I have found a clinical trial that applies to me, but my doctor is unsure the trial is a good fit, should I get a second opinion? So I'm going to start with Dr. Anthony. And
I think that's a wonderful question. When you find a clinical trial, whether it's a wonderful fit or not, it really depends on what condition you're in and where you live, and then some of the hardships that we've talked about, distance to the center and cost. So if the physician looking at this has some concerns, it might actually be helpful to contact someone who's participating in that site. And I would encourage that, because if you don't talk to someone who's actually conducting the trial and go under screening to a certain extent, a limited amount if you have to travel, then you really haven't answered your question. So if you want to participate, then go for the answer with the people who have the most information.
Excellent. And Dr. Lennon, do you want to?
Sure. I think it is important to understand the reasons why a doctor might might argue against a clinical trial. If it's a situation as if you're too sick, you need treatment right away, I think you have to take that seriously, but sometimes you can enroll quite quickly in clinical trials, but you have to trust the person there right with you at the time in that sort of judgment to some degree. I think if they know that you're not going to be eligible because you may have gotten some information and think you're eligible, but they know the details of your case and are aware that you're not eligible for that, that's something worth knowing, although I would agree with Dr. Anthony that touching base with the people running the trial might in some cases give you a more precise answer around that because it's not always clear. But in general, I think in most situations, people do tend to have a little bit of time. I mean, we tend to think in cancer that this is obviously it's serious most of the time, or all of the time, I should say. But we often think, well, we've got to start treatment tomorrow. And I think generally in cancer care, and specifically with respect to clinical trials, being able to take a breath, get educated, learn about the options a little bit more, whether it's a clinical trial or something else, is often a very good idea and something you ought to consider, whether it's a second opinion just in general or a second opinion specifically about clinical trials. And one of the good things about clinical trials is that while many are done in the community by general oncologists, in some cases they're done at a referral center that has some expertise and sees more patients with given situations, and that can often be helpful to patients even just to get a one-time opinion with regard to their management and care because of the nuances and the details of some of these cancers that can be quite specific and complex.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Mitchell?
So I agree with our previous speakers. I think it's very important for patients to, number one, feel comfortable with the anticipated treatment, and number two, feel that they have enough information. It's so important to develop that comfort zone prior to embarking on therapy, and therefore, always seek that information. You can get more additional information from your own physician or another center, and sometimes you might have to travel for that second opinion at another center that is perhaps a high volume center for that disease process, but it's always important to get information and to make sure you understand the information. So if you have to go to one or two different sites to increase and enhance your comfort zone that you know as much as you need, don't hesitate to do it. So second opinions can be very important.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another online participant, Pam, who is a clinical trial nurse. And she really is making a statement about the fact that she feels that my clinical trial participants a very selfless, self-sacrificing decision to volunteer for a clinical trial that may or may not help them. And she really wanted to just comment on that. And I wonder if our speakers want to just comment on the fact that those who participate in clinical trials, that they are really rather amazing people very often. And so, Dr. Mitchell, would you like to comment on that?
Certainly. So some clinical trials may be designed such that they don't offer tremendous benefit to the individual participant at that time. And again, these are questions that you need to ask the clinical trial staff. What is the importance of this trial? Who is it going to benefit? Will I benefit at all? Will I benefit in the future? And all of this is a part of the written document that is the protocol and or the consent form. Most of these potential benefits as well as risk are included in the consent form, which the individual patient should be given a copy of that consent form to keep and to read. So very, very important to discuss that with the clinical trial staff.
Thank you. And our next question, Kate?
I'm showing we have a question from the line of William D. Your line is open.
Thank you. I understand that there were some statistics showing that less than 10% of people with cancer actually enter into trials in adult populations. And I'm wondering if there's any empirical evidence as to why people do not enroll in trials. I also have heard that oncologists are reluctant to refer people to trials because they see it as competitive, as losing their patients to the trials, or they don't see it in their scope of practice. They don't have enough time or facilities to talk about trials, and very few actually discuss trials with patients. Is that the case too?
Well, thank you. Those are excellent questions. I'm going to ask all of our speakers to address it. Why don't I start with Dr. Mitchell, and we'll have everybody address your questions because they're good ones and they are often on people's minds. So, Dr. Mitchell?
Yes, thank you. So there are a number of reasons why individuals don't participate in clinical trials. Number one, the availability of those trials, the location, whether or not there is actually good standard treatment for a given cancer, the location of clinical trials, and how many people participate in clinical trials. For example, I mentioned the pediatric clinical trials earlier. Since there are fewer children than adults presenting with cancers, pediatricians have gotten together throughout the country, and those clinical trials are available to almost every child that develops cancers. For adults with cancer, since there are more individuals developing cancers, there are also not only more clinical trials in different places, but also there is the greater availability of standard treatment. So many individuals, as well as many physicians, prefer to utilize standard treatment for a number of reasons. So there are multiple reasons why clinical trials either are not available or individuals choose not to participate in a clinical trial.
Thank you. And Dr. Leonard?
Well, I think that in some cases the caller is correct, and as Dr. Mitchell said, there are a number of reasons that can add up to interfering with participation in clinical trials. I guess I would spin it around the other way, and I would say that since this is an audience largely of patients and caregivers, I would focus on what a caregiver can do and a patient can do in this regard. And I think the biggest thing is to ask questions, to ask your doctor whether or not a clinical trial is right for you. And I think that in many cases, the doctor will give a satisfactory answer and either offer a trial or outline why that they feel that it's not appropriate or perhaps not appropriate. And in some cases, the patients will have to go elsewhere to get additional information for whatever reason. And I think oncologists, to their credit, are among the leaders in participation in clinical trials, although I would certainly agree that across the country in various settings, both academically and in the community, enough patients do not go on studies. But I think, generally speaking, oncologists are aware of clinical trials and recognize the importance of clinical trials. There may be many barriers, but I think what a patient and caregivers can do is to ask, to seek information, and there are plenty of resources out there. Cancer Care can also help with this, as well as other excellent organizations out there that support the importance and the facilitation of clinical trials. And so I would certainly seek information and take it into your hands, as with all aspects of your health care, to get this information and make sure that the decisions you're making and the opportunities you have are really the best thing for you.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Anthony?
Well, I think the caller has some really
good points in terms of what are the conflicts. I think a physician, when he or she takes care of a cancer patient, there's a strong commitment of doing what's best for that patient. And if the physician thinks that they have a lot to offer, and it's going to be quite upsetting to the patient to be traveling a far distance to a trial, that itself could limit the enthusiasm of the physician wanting to promote or encourage his patients early on to participate. So frequently we'll see clinical trials being done in people who have failed standard of care, and there's trials specifically for that. One of the things that I've encountered in my practice is patients may be very enthusiastic about participating, and then when it comes down to the actual cost, the insurance company is the final determinant. Another factor is that if it's an uncommon disease, the patient's family will demand that the patient go and get a second opinion, and that second opinion would obviously include a possible clinical trial. So a lot of times it depends on what the disease is, how many treatment choices, how far away you are, what your insurance situation is, and what the family members are either they're unhappy, dissatisfied, or they're the ones in the background helping guide the ship.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I have to say you are just an amazing team of physicians. I want to thank you just really for just this fantastic call on clinical trials. I can't thank you enough. You've all been extremely knowledgeable and caring in your delivery today. I want to thank all of you who also asked questions today. I really think that always adds to our call as well. And all of you, of course, for listening. I want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour program and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so I do want to go over with you all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. And there are many. Cancer Care has many oncology social workers on staff, and we're here to provide a host of services for you, from actually counseling services, a chance to talk with our staff, to actually a chance to actually review any concerns or questions you may have or get more information. We also offer support groups, both on the telephone and online, and we also offer practical and financial assistance, as well as, of course, workshops like this. We have many workshops like this coming up, and we also have many publications and booklets that, of course, would be of interest to you as well. Most importantly, and of course, we have a very active website as well. So basically, there are so many different things that you can access from Cancer Care, and I really want to invite you to take advantage of these free services. You can call us at 1-800-813-4673, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Most importantly, however, as we conclude the program today, I don't want you to think that you're alone in coping with cancer or in thinking about participating in a clinical trial. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and we're here to help you. And we're here to help you in every way that we possibly can. Please do call us, and I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for participating.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.